The Tom Woods Show, episode 1924.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Cheeky Maiden Soap is a family-run business operated by people who listen to and love The Tom Woods Show. They make all-natural soaps and other cleansers that you're absolutely going to love. Take 25% off your order when you go to CheekyMaidenSoap.com and use coupon code WOODS. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Well, critical race theory does not seem to be exiting the news cycle anytime soon, so I've invited back James Lindsay, who, with Helen Pluckrose, is the author of the book Cynical Theories: How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity, and Why This Harms Everybody. Linking to it at tomwoods.com/1924. We've seen governors banning the teaching of critical race theory. It's very controversial, so we want to talk about exactly what it is and what, if anything, needs to be done about it. So, James, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
All right, look, I figure you're probably sick and tired of defining what critical race theory is, but the consolation is, as you say in your book, it's a little bit easier to define critical race theory because it's not just meaningless gobbledygook. And you say that maybe that's because it's rooted in critical legal theory and this is something substantial and finite and identifiable. So we can actually know what it is and what its tenets are and what it's aiming for. So just for the sake of completeness, how would you define what critical race theory is?
You know, I could give a bunch of answers to this, but you are right. In comparison to some of these other theories we talked about in cynical theories, like queer theory, which says that it's an identity without an essence, which just makes it pretty hard to define. Critical race theory did arise within law, and its earliest expositors were lawyers. And so they wrote down pretty clear definitions. So, you know, their definition for critical race theory is that it is a movement, which is a red flag word already. It is a movement that's taking place between activists and scholars working primarily in law and beyond to change the relationship between race, racism, and power. That's not a very descriptive definition. You could also say that it is the application of the methods of critical theory, which is to say neo-Marxism, to race, in accordance with the calls that the late Herbert Marcuse was making in the 1960s. In all three of his kind of biggest works of the 1960s, he points out that they have to recruit the racial minorities, or as he puts it, the ghetto populations or whatever, to become the new vanguard of neo-Marxist agitation and activism. And so you could see it as neo-Marxism, which is a derivative of Marxism, obviously, using race rather than, say, economic class or consumer society or something like that as the vector. I like to give a definition of my own writing or my own making that I think cuts through the BS. Critical race theory is the belief that systemic racism is the fundamental organizing principle of society and that it was created by white people in order to disenfranchise and to continue disenfranchising people of color or non-white people, especially black people. And I think that that's actually the best way to understand what critical race theory is. It's the belief that society is organized around racism that white people created and maintain up to this day, specifically to disenfranchise other people. And it takes specially trained experts or specialists called critical race theorists to be able to find out how racism is present in everything and underneath everything and how to pick at that.
It's so important what you've just said, because you may recall during one of the presidential debates, the subject came up. And as usual, and I don't mean just on this subject, I mean on a lot of subjects, Trump was completely unprepared, had no real answer. And Biden's answer was, well, I don't see what the problem is in making sure that we make people feel good about themselves and we don't accidentally insult people and we just try to be polite to each other, as if that's what critical race theory is. And Trump missed an enormous opportunity right there to correct him and say, if that's what it was, who in his right mind would be against that?
Yeah, the thing is, unfortunately, President Trump is not the most disciplined character in the world. I think he intuits what's going on with critical race theory pretty well, given the amount of briefing he had had on it, but he didn't have the specific understanding. And that allowed Biden to step in and it allowed him to say things that don't properly characterize critical race theory, that kind of put a nice pretty shine on it. I mean, for a couple of years now, I've been explaining that all of these theories of critical social justice, including critical race theory, proceed. You can think of it like you've bought a product that has a really slick packaging, and then the thing inside is crap. And they're really good at putting out that packaging whenever they get you know, anybody's giving them any pushback, any scrutiny, anybody's paying attention, then they portray it, oh, well, it's a special way to look at racial sensitivity training. It's a proper way to understand the history of racism in America, including slavery and Jim Crow and redlining and all of this. It's just a particular way to really dig that up and really understand it in a deeper way than we've ever done before, where everything else, in, by comparison, is basically whitewashing history. They're really good at showing, because they kind of have relied heavily on public relations, the school of thought of Edward Bernays, the great propagandist, is at the root of a lot of their preceding theory. They're really good at putting out that marketing gloss about what they're actually doing without diving into the fact that they believe things like that racism is the ordinary state of affairs in society, and that we have to question at its very foundations. And this is a quote, by the way, directly out of both of these things that I've just said, are a quote directly out of Critical Race Theory, an introduction by Richard Delgado and Gene Stefanchik. They say that they're skeptical of rights. They say that racism is the ordinary state of affairs in society. And they say that critical race theory calls into question the very foundations of the liberal order, including legal reasoning, equality theory, enlightenment rationalism, and the neutral principles of constitutional law, which is a much more radical proposition than, oh, we just want to look at history and we want to have racial sensitivity.
Right. In fact, that quotation stood out to me more than anything else in your chapter on this subject, because to say critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, and then, as you say, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law. And they start that sentence by saying, unlike traditional civil rights discourse. So I want to ask a little bit about that, because the civil rights movement that we read about in our textbooks was premised, I think, on the idea that by appealing to the better nature of the white majority, we can make progress, and that obviously, it was a multiracial movement, the civil rights movement, but all these people thought that the majority of whites who have up to now been either indifferent or frankly hostile to the position of blacks in American society might be brought to their senses by the kinds of moral appeals that we make. But it seems that critical race theory says that not just that that's been a failure, but that that was an impossible, that was a fool's errand to begin with.
Oh, it's worse than that. As a matter of fact, what you have, whether you look back to the abolitionist Frederick Douglass, the, you know, the escaped slave who spoke so eloquently in the 1850s and going forward, whether you look at Martin Luther King, you see them not just appealing to Americans or you say white people, but to Americans' better nature. You see them appealing to the American ideal, the American foundational documents. They are appealing to America and Americanism as the root to make equality central, as it was promised in 1776. You know, all men are created equal. Let's live up to that. That's not a complicated idea. And critical race theory not only says these things, not only does it repudiate that approach, it goes further and actually says that that approach was a conspiracy. It was making, say, the civil rights leaders of the 1960s operate on what they would say are white terms. That appealing to the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, is appealing on white terms. And so that what's going on, this is the thesis that's known as the interest convergence thesis of Derrick Bell, the founder of critical race theory, is that what's really going on is that white people and the white society, the white system or white superstructure, let me just use the right word, is forcing black people to participate in a way that appeals to white people so that white people can feel better about themselves and so that white people can arrange this new emerging system post-civil rights for their own advantage. And they only are going to go through with this because it's to their own advantage. So it's a very cynical and paranoid theory in that regard. And regarding the civil rights, you say, you know, it says unlike traditional approaches to civil rights. Well, let me just be very clear about what they actually say. They say unlike traditional approaches to civil rights, which favors incrementalism and step-by-step progress. So unlike incrementalism and step-by-step progress, what is the alternative? Well, it's revolution. So this is a revolutionary movement. They describe themselves as a movement. This is a revolutionary movement that repudiates neutrality, equality, the liberal order, enlightenment rationalism, the Constitution. So when Trump blurted out that this is an anti-American ideology, he was absolutely correct, although he didn't have the ability or the discipline to be able to articulate why. And there it is in the very first paragraph, by the way. That's all we're talking about right here. The very first paragraph of a textbook called Critical Race Theory, an Introduction.
Well, here's the difference between the two from what I can see. It lies in plausibility. If you live in a majority white country and your premise is that white people are inherently racist and whether they mean to be or not, that's just the way it is. And first of all, that sounds like a formula for despair. What could you do? Well, one thing you could do is try to make gains where you can make them And then as, again, also as people interact with each other on a more regular basis, maybe, you know, maybe some of the hostility begins to melt away, you know, and you make little progress a little bit at a time. But if you are in a majority white society and your thesis is that the majority is just irredeemable, that we can't gradually and slowly and incrementally bring them around, what does the revolution look like if it's fought against the majority of the country? How would it occur? I mean, what does it actually look like? What's the end point and how do they get there?
I mean, the revolution occurs, given that this movement is ultimately Bolshevik in organization, the revolution occurs in some technologically updated form. Obviously, we are not in 1917, but technologically updated form of what Lenin pulled on the Soviet Union, or what Russia, which became the Soviet Union. You're going to have a cadre of people who are critical race theorists who are going to empower themselves and enrich themselves and dictate to everybody else what is right, what is wrong, how you can live and how you can't. So the revolution proceeds by empowering a cadre of racially enlightened people who are going to then try to usher in an era of racial enlightenment to the populace that doesn't have this consciousness like they do, which is exactly the Bolshevik model, which is, in other words, the Soviet model. And so it's racial Sovietism is how it proceeds. And you can then therefore imagine what it's going to look like when we get there. You're going to have certain empowered people, and it won't really matter too much what your skin color is. It'll matter some. Because if, for example, if you look at any of the black people who've spoken up against critical race theory, whether it's Senator Tim Scott very recently, whether it's Kanye West a few years ago, immediately, you know, they just get called all these names. They get disqualified. You could look at Justice Clarence Thomas. They don't really count him as black. So what you're going to have is a cadre of people. It's a relatively small minority of people who claim that they have racial consciousness, who are then going to increasingly, in a more and more totalitarian fashion, dictate how everybody's supposed to live so that we can have a racially enlightened society under their command and under their purview. And it'll be, you know, mostly, I don't think that we're as likely to see power, as Mao put it, flowing from the barrel of a gun as we are to see power flowing from the strictures of social credit and other digital forms of control in the current era. But the possibility is certainly there. We've seen ugly hints that this is kind of the direction that it leads when we look at cities like Chicago recently. So that's what this revolution looks like. Them in control with their departments of anti-racism that have the power to veto anything in the three branches of the federal government. That's Ibram Kendi's idea, or whatever it happens to be. That's the general idea.
You mentioned people who disagree with them, who are clearly people of color. And it sounds like there's an analogy between this and the way the traditional Marxist would have viewed a worker who, let's say, read a book by Ludwig von Mises and thought that the market society is the best, that he's suffering from false consciousness. Is that the way they look at it, or is it even worse, or how do they explain that?
No, that's basically it. You know, what you have then is somebody, they would refer to it as internalized racism, or there's another term that they sometimes apply that's acting white, that the overarching white superstructure, white supremacist superstructure of society forces people who want to succeed to abandon their own cultural identity and to act within the strictures of white, or as I say, white supremacist culture. So when you saw that document that came out from the National African American History Museum from the Smithsonian last year that got a lot of attention and play, that said, here are the factors of white supremacy culture. And it's stuff like showing up to work on time, punctuality, hard work, you know, dedication or loyalty or whatever. I mean, there are all of these things that are basically just virtues for a society that wants to flourish, taking responsibility, perfectionism. And then when you see the same thing happening in the education system across all three states on the West Coast, and they say, you know, what does white supremacy culture look like in math? Well, it's like caring whether there's a right answer. When you see that kind of stuff going on, what they're saying is that people who want to succeed are forced to participate in that kind of a culture. And they're forced to therefore act white or place themselves, if it's like an Asian or a Latino, as white adjacent. And this logic obviously is really dangerous and really poisonous because it sets up a racial identity as a type of culture that is the source of all the problems that leads to this despair you're talking about under what they refer to as structural determinism, that the superstructure, white supremacy of society, determines people's outcomes in lives, whether that's privilege or oppression. So when you say that this looks very much like kind of a false consciousness, there are two aspects to that that they theorize. One is people who don't realize that they have internalized this society. They think that virtues like hard work and punctuality are good or normal or productive or something like this. And so they've internalized that and they have false consciousness, or they're cynically using that to advance themselves, as they accuse President Obama of having done so that he could become president, in a book titled Acting White, as it turns out.
What do you think about these efforts by governors to prohibit the teaching of critical race theory in schools?
You know, I think that this is extremely important. I actually was the first person, as far as I know, to make a call for this. I wrote an essay about this on my website, New Discourses, I think back in November last year. As soon as I realized, I even realized it before Biden took office. I knew once Biden took office, the executive order that Trump had put forth for federal agencies did not cover state agencies, because people immediately started to write to me after the Trump's executive order was passed. And they said, you know, does this protect me as a worker of the state of Oregon or the state of California or state of Kentucky? And I was like, no, it doesn't protect you at the state level. The states need to enact similar either legislation or executive orders, ideally legislation. And so I wrote an appeal defending the executive order and calling for it to be expanded at the state level. And I mentioned that Biden was, who had been elected by the time I wrote this, was definitely going to repeal Trump's executive order, which he did on the first day, literally the first day. And the thing is, though, is that this is a crucial step, because what you have to understand is that the critical race theory mindset is one that is wholly focused on power and that believes that power is wholly mediated through race and racism, which is somewhat less important. You actually, though, when you have people whose only way of thinking is about power, you actually have to apply power back to them. And it's the only thing you can do. If you try to talk them out of it, if you try to appeal to their better nature, they don't respect reason, they don't respect evidence, they think that they are completely righteous and holy in what they're doing, they're not going to be persuaded. And if you try to appeal to their better nature, they think that they're on the right side of history, so they don't have one. They don't have a better nature to appeal to on this. Their better nature tells them this is the only thing to do. So you can't talk them out of this. You actually have to remove them from positions of power, or at least legally limit them in what they can do, and then start to try to hold them accountable when they violate that, which they openly say that they will do. The critical race theorists in education have openly said, in every state that I'm aware of, that one of these pieces of legislation has been proposed, well, they can ban it, but I'll still do it. I'll just change the words. They won't know. Or I'll just do it anyway. And those people just have to be fired. Because when you have people who are in this kind of a position, the only thing you can do is that. And you need legislation that just all these pieces of legislation do is back up the civil rights laws that already exist that aren't being enforced. You need legislation to justify removing people from power who are just abusing their positions of power and who cannot actually be persuaded because they've left the realm of being persuadable. But that said, they're also just a first step. As I said, you know, you have people who are saying, well, ban it if you want, I'm going to do it anyway. Well, then the law is just a piece of paper. It's got to be enforced. People are going to have to still understand what this is. They're going to have to show up to their school boards. They're going to have to start doing the hard work of changing the curricula. They're going to have to do the hard work of challenging the teachers' unions that are protecting this and keeping this in. They're going to have to do a lot of hard work. It's just a first step of, if I had to guess, probably 20 or 30 steps. But I think it's a crucial step.
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute. The critical race theorists have said that they call into question some of the principles of the Enlightenment. But couldn't somebody say James Lindsay, in not allowing freedom of speech in the classroom, is himself attacking Enlightenment principles?
No, because Enlightenment principles don't give the state free speech. A public school is a ward of the state. It is the state's mouthpiece to children who parents entrust to educate and take care of their children responsibly. They do not send their kids to school to be indoctrinated in racism, which is in violation of the civil rights law. They don't send their children to school to be segregated, to be racially scapegoated if they're of a so-called privileged race, and to be racially stereotyped if they're of a minority race. And the state doesn't have free speech. So, you know, it's a really interesting little tactic that the critical race theorists activists have pulled here to say, oh no, we have free speech. We have free speech. We should be able to say whatever we want in the classroom. But that's absolutely not true. The state does not have the ability to compel speech in teachers, does not have the freedom to compel speech in students. It does not actually have the capacity to speak freely because it is the state. Now, if you're in a private school, it's a different matter. But if you're in a private school, you're parents have a little bit more leverage. They can pull their kid out, for example. They can send them to a different private school. The principles of the market apply. But when you have public schools, That's the state. The state doesn't get free speech. The point of free speech or the First Amendment is to protect individuals from the state, whether that's protecting them from having to say something, compelled speech, to protect their right to say something, to protect their right to hear something, to protect their right to not be, you know, silenced or whatever. So these are the things that the First Amendment protects. So this is a total canard. And it's a hilarious canard because the critical race theorists don't want free speech anyway. They're just appealing to it in order to manipulate the situation to maintain their power that they're abusing. But schools don't have free speech. I mean, that's a ridiculous proposition in the first place.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Cheeky Maiden Soap. Cheeky Maiden Soap is a company run by libertarians and Tom Wood Show listeners. It's run by a family, actually. They make all their products in Georgia, and they truly are artists when it comes to soap, because as I know from being a user of their soap, by the way, I am exploring all the different kinds of soap they have, having an absolute blast doing it. They can perfectly blend a few oils to get just the right lather, cleansing, and scent. They formulated all their products to be non-toxic, even down to the laundry soap and household cleaners they make. I got myself a huge box of a sample of everything they make, and I'm going through it one at a time, having an absolute blast, and knowing that, of course, the skin is the largest organ you have, and you should treat it well, for heaven's sake. Put nice things on it. Lather with nice things, not bad things and harsh things, nice things. And that's what you get with Cheeky Maiden Soap. Well, take 25% off with code WOODS at CheekyMaidenSoap.com. That's 25% off with code WOODS at CheekyMaidenSoap.com. All right, let's shift gears to a topic you cover at some length in this particular chapter of your book, and that is intersectionality. Now, obviously, an awful lot of time could be spent on this. The average person will never know or remember any of the names of people who write deeply on the subject of intersectionality. So what is it about this topic that they do need to know?
So what they need to know, because you have to be able to defend against the reasonable exposition that you'll hear, is that there is a very reasonable observation that I don't think is a simple one in terms of what to do about it in the law, but I think it is a reasonable observation that underlies everything. So what intersectionality is, and I say that to preface that the rest of the thing is entirely batshit insane. So what intersectionality is that you have to understand yourself in terms of all of the different forms of identity you have. Maybe you're a person of color, maybe you're a woman. So that's two different things that you have to take into account. Maybe you're a man and you're a person of color. That's two different things you have to take into account. Maybe you're gay, maybe you're straight, maybe you're cis, maybe you're trans, maybe you're disabled, maybe you're doubly disabled, maybe you're triply disabled, maybe you're overweight. You have to take into account all of these different factors of identity to understand where you are, as in this is their word, positioned in society in relation to the systems of power that they believe structure society. So critical race theory believes that racism structures society. But if we switch over to queer theory, they believe that something called cis heteronormativity structures society. If we switch over to feminism, they believe that patriarchy and misogyny structure society. If we switch over to disability studies, they think that ableism and disablism structure society. And so they see this as a complicated matrix of power systems. And you have to figure out where you are positioned against that. And your group identity within each of those becomes the most relevant thing about you. And that's why I said that it's actually insane when you get past it. Just so people know, though, there is a reasonable observation. It began in law, just like critical race theory. And they observed that Black women can be uniquely discriminated against in a place that hires enough Black men and white women, for example, not to discriminate by sex and not to discriminate by race. So you do have this kind of loophole that's a complicated loophole in law where you could discriminate very specifically against Black women by hiring lots of Black men, hiring lots of white women, and keeping the Black women out. And that could be intentional discrimination. And I think that there is a valid legal observation and argument and discussion to be had there. And I understand it's a very complicated one because as you start to go into, like, you know, 17 different categories of identity, now you have a complete disaster on your hands for figuring out how to adjudicate discrimination. But there is some validity there because it turns out there are a lot of, say, Black women or a lot of Latinas or whatever it happens to be. There's some validity there that needs to be, I think, grappled with and needed to be grappled with in discrimination law. And that's where the observation began. And then it got turned into, oh, your position against all of these Marxian systems of power, whether it's class, whether it's race, whether it's sexuality, whether it's sex, whether it's gender, whether all of these things, That's how you have to understand yourself. You are a member of these groups. And you have to start every sentence that you say with as a blah, blah, blah. I'm privileged in these ways and I'm oppressed in those ways. And that's relevant to what I have to say because I know when I get to speak with authority, if I have oppression, I know when I have to shut up and listen, when I have privilege, yada, yada, yada. And so it's actually become a way to overwhelmingly focus on identity. It increases what we would call identity salience, and to kind of navel gaze about what that means about you, and then to kind of identify your ideas with who you believe yourself to be. You no longer, under intersectionality, are a person who happens to be whatever identity, where the person comes first, and the creator of intersectionality named Kimberly Crenshaw explicitly says that we shouldn't strive for that universality, she says, and rather we have to lean into the identities that are imposed by these power structures in society. So you are a Black person, not a person who happens to be Black. You are a disabled person where society has disabled you by not catering to your every challenge in life, rather than a person who happens to have a disability. You are a gay person rather than a person who happens to be gay. So the person is put second, the identity is put first, and then you have to kind of navigate this complicated, they call it a matrix of domination, that tells you where you fit in society, what you have authority to say and what you don't, based on how oppressed you are versus how privileged you are, with oppression conferring speech and privilege conferring silence.
Well, as an observer of all this, it would seem to me that it's equally plausible that one might say, here we have these socially constructed categories that have more or less been imposed on me. So my response is to defiantly ignore them. And yet, you would think that would be at least equally plausible as an answer.
Right. So Crenshaw actually engages that and says that it's not possible because they are imposed. That's what she says. You know, you actually cannot defiantly ignore categories that are being imposed upon you, whether you like it or not. Her claim is that if you are oppressed, you don't have the power to do that, which I think is a completely disempowering message. But there's another thing I'd like to pivot to buried within this. In this, then, she observes that you, A, have to have power to impose a racial category on somebody, and B, have to have even more power to impose a negative valence to that. And that's racism, and that's bad, right? To impose a racial category on a group requires power, and it's bad to do that, especially if what you're imposing is a negative stereotype. So then we turn to Robin DiAngelo, very famous critical whiteness educator, that's how she describes herself, who says there's no such thing in her book, White Fragility, there's no such thing as a positive white identity. And it's wrong to strive for a positive white identity. You should strive to be less white. We should strive to abolish whiteness. You see this in the Coca-Cola diversity training materials. They pick that up specifically. Coca-Cola wants its employees to be less white. And so they are imposing a white racial identity on white people and saying that it cannot be positive, which reveals A, that they have power, B, that they're doing racism explicitly and intentionally, and C, that they're doing so knowing it's bad. So the best you can possibly say about this way of thinking is that it is an attempt to level the playing field through vengeance and to bring everybody down to the place where they suffer racism, rather than actually they claim that they're doing liberation. They're not liberating anybody from anything. They're throwing the shackles on everybody instead. And they know that it's wrong. They've written copiously about how that specific thing that they are intentionally doing is wrong.
There are so many paradoxes in all this. Yet I can imagine somebody who homeschools his kids thinking, well, thank goodness I don't have to deal with this. Because obviously the schools are the central battleground right now. But if you're trying to educate somebody into something, the idea is that once they leave school, they're going to do something with it. So I think it would be short-sighted to say, well, thank goodness I don't have to deal with the public schools and whatever crazy things the kids are being taught. Why do you think it would be short-sighted for a homeschooling family to think, well, thank goodness we don't have to deal with this, so we're just going to pay no attention to it?
There's like 10 answers to that, too. One of the reasons is what you just alluded to, is that they are attempting to take everybody they can get their hands on and to use them to restructure society so that it doesn't matter what your kids learn, they're going to have to deal with this. And because this is a totalizing ideology, and in fact totalitarian in nature, dealing with it is going to become an integral part of your experience if they continue to gain and amass power and continue. And everybody says to indoctrinate kids, but I want to make it more clear. They're not indoctrinating, they're programming kids. They're teaching them to think in a particular way. This is where, for example, the campaign in Florida that says, you know, we're going to teach kids how to think, not what to think, actually misses. They are teaching people how to think in a very miserable, resentment-laden way. And that's a very much different and more dangerous thing than indoctrination. This is a genuine programming of our children in a racist ideology. They're programming them to think as critical theorists think. But that said, you know, it's naive to think that you're going to be able to just homeschool your kids and avoid a society that's going to be increasingly structured in that way. It's also naive to think that they're going to let you keep homeschooling your kids. Or you say, well, I have freedom. Not if a totalitarian regime gets in control, you don't have any freedom. And the more control they get, the more that's going to be the case. You might lose the ability. They've already argued that homeschooling should be illegal. They're already operationalizing that playing field so that they can make sure that maybe one day they can control that if they get the power to do so. You can say the Constitution protects this or that, but you're going to find out real fast that if they get enough power, the Constitution doesn't really exist beyond being a piece of paper that they can sometimes contort to their own advantage. And at the very least, you would expect they're going to say that if you want to have your homeschooled child count as a educated person, a graduated person with the equivalent of a high school diploma, well, they're going to have to be competent in diversity, equity, and inclusion as taught through these things. So you're going to have to teach it to them anyway. And so they'll co-opt you as the homeschooling parent to teach your children things that you took them out of school specifically so they wouldn't have to learn. And I don't think people realize that what we are actually dealing with is the attempted takeover of a genuine totalitarian ideology that has a big head start on everybody. So while I think pulling kids out of public schools, maybe taking up homeschooling, is A, going to protect them and help them in the future if we win, B, send a signal to the schools and to the state that we're really upset about this, as far as if they actually succeed in turning over society in this way, it's not going to be any more protection than if you were trying to homeschool your kids in the Soviet Union. And you really should start thinking about it that way.
Well, this is a really, really sobering episode. I mean, I thought I more or less had a handle on what was going on, but it's actually, in preparing for this and then in talking to you, I realize it's much, much worse. And of course, we're dealing with people. I happen to have the crazy anti or counter-revolutionary view that most people are people of goodwill, that I think if they were familiar with what's being taught here, would just be left flabbergasted. They wouldn't even know how to respond. The idea that I'm subconsciously or consciously organizing my life around oppressing people who are unlike myself, that's just not true.
Yeah, that's the thing, is the vast majority of people do not actually understand what this is, because it engages in a specific type of abusive language where they use words that people are familiar with, but they have at least two different meanings that they can therefore use as a tool to manipulate people with. So you could use, for example, the word diversity. Well, obviously diversity means we're going to have people from all over, different kinds, blah, blah, blah. You know, we're going to have people of different races, people of different sexes, people of different sexualities, whatever it is that we mean by diversity. But they in fact mean people who are trained in the ideology of diversity, are people who are actually diverse. And so they actually are talking about apparatchiks and commissars. And so they're sliding in the Sovietization under words that sound like, yeah, everybody should want that. How in the world could you oppose that? And if you do try to oppose it, they say, what, you're against diversity? You just want everything to be white? And they catch you on your heels and they make you feel bad. And like basically every word that you can possibly imagine that has any political utility or valence, they've probably co-opted it. In education, they've stolen social emotional learning, for example, which is a specialized term. They've stolen the term democracy. I cringe every time I hear a woke Democrat say the phrase something like, we're trying to protect democracy, or this is in favor of democracy or whatever, because I've read the communist literature. I've read Lenin on democracy, where he says that communism is the only form of true democracy. Because if anybody has more power or more money or more resources or more privilege than anybody else, they don't have equal voice. So they don't have a true democracy. You only have a true democracy under communism. So for them, the word democracy presupposes communism. And so you kind of have to wonder every time they say it, which one of these things do you mean? And we're like, rah, 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 democracy, even though we live in a republic that uses democracy as a electoral tool. And we're cheering on what might actually be a cloaked term for something that none of us, or very few of us, I should say, would agree with. So yeah, I think it's greater than 80%. Are in the category that you say, though, that if they understood what's actually going on, they would be appalled, they would be angry, they would be flabbergasted, they would reject it outright. But getting people, my experience over the past 3 years trying to teach people about this stuff has been that if I tell them, they don't believe me. If I show them proof in the literature, they say I must be misinterpreting it. They just cannot get their head around the idea that this is actually what it is, because it's so dressed up in professional, jargony, and pleasant, flowery sounding language that appeals to the exact moral views that they have. And just to point this out, we had a Communist Party USA defector, Bella Dodd, Dr. Bella Dodd, in the 1950s testified to the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And she said this is exactly how the communists would try to make their move in America. She said that they were going to use language that is appealing to Americans. Communism will come to America dressed in words like democracy. It will come dressed in words that Americans find pleasant. And they do this very much on purpose.
Well, I would say if you have not yet read Cynical Theories by Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay, our guests today, now is probably the time. So the book is Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity, and Why This Harms Everybody. I'll link to it on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/1924. James, chances are we're going to need to have you back, you know, because probably this won't be gone by the day after this episode comes out. And it is so very important if we want to maintain a decent society, or a society any of us would recognize or care to live in.
I think that's probably correct, unfortunately. Now is the time. We actually have to stand up and say no to this everywhere it occurs. Firmly and confidently, I want everybody that listens to this, by the way, to know you have the evidence, you have the argument, you have the moral high ground. They're trying to pretend they have those things and they don't. You have them, so be confident.
Well said. Thank you, James.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Okay, everybody, listen, I am on my way to Porkfest tonight, so I am racing out the door. I've been spending a couple of days in Boston, which I love so much, and don't you send me emails saying, but don't you know Boston is run by terrible people? Yeah, I know, but basically everywhere on Earth practically is run by terrible people. I'm not going to let the terrorists win. I love this place. I grew up around here. But now it's time to head to Porkfest, so I am zipping on out the door, hoping to meet some of you over the next couple of days. If not, I hope to meet you at Freedom Fest next month, July 2021. Use code WOODS50 to take $50 off the registration fee at freedomfest.com. See you soon.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.